Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
A commercial moon boom. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. As NASA sets its sights on the lunar surface with its Artemis missions, the commercial space world is eagerly awaiting a new lunar boom. We'll speak with Rob Meyerson, former president and senior executive at Blue Origin, about how commercial companies are joining in on the excitement for a new chapter in lunar exploration. But first, honoring Native American traditions is helping to build a better world. PBS's Native America explores contemporary Native cultures here in the U.S., and its upcoming season profiles innovative Natives, including Aaron Yazzie, a NASA engineer working on the agency's Mars rovers. We'll discuss how his Navajo traditions have shaped his Martian future. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Honoring traditions and making discoveries. Now, in its second season, Native America, a PBS documentary series, is highlighting indigenous communities and their impact on the contemporary world. That includes the work of Aaron Yazzie, an engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. He shared his experience working at NASA in an episode called New Worlds, which explores honoring Native American traditions while advancing into the 21st century. Aaron joins us now to talk about that episode and his experience. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, likewise. So Aaron, let's talk a little bit about the show you're participating in from PBS. Tell us a bit about how this came to be and what your role in it is.
Yeah, so this PBS show is called Native America. It's the second season of this show, and I'm going to be involved in the first episode of the second season. And the title of this episode is New Worlds. And sort of the producing team reached out to a few different Native Americans around the U.S. who are doing things that are advancing us into the new worlds, things that deal with STEM technology and how we can combine things like math and science into our traditional ways. And they reached out to me because I am currently working for NASA on our big Mars mission, the Mars 2020 Perseverance rover. I got to build the drill bits for that mission, which is currently on Mars, drilling into rocks, gathering samples to bring home. And so now, actually, my role is for Mars sample return. I'm working to help bring those sample tubes to Earth so that we could study them and look to see if Mars at any point in its history had once had ancient microbial life. And so I just being a modern Native American, I'm Navajo, actually. I'm from the Southwest. I grew up in Northern Arizona. Just being somebody from that community who is now doing this kind of work, we always work to try to exist and survive, thrive in both of our worlds, but I've always worked in everything that I've done to try to combine my two worlds. Not to say that all of my traditional Navajo culture side of me is in the past or something that I need to switch over to. It's like it can be part of NASA as well. It can be part of the discoveries that we're making every day.
Aaron, you mentioned your heritage is Navajo. Can you tell me a little bit about how that was like growing up and what part of that culture maybe inspired you to go about this STEM path and then eventually getting you to NASA and JPL. Tell me a bit about those early years of Aaron and what that was like.
Yeah, for sure. So I was born in Tuba City, Arizona, which is right on the Navajo Nation. It's where my mother's family is from. They're all still from that area. So when I go home, I see like tons of like uncles and aunties and cousins and stuff. And I go home often. I try to go home as much as I can. And pretty soon after I was born, we actually moved to what we call a border town. So it was maybe 10 minutes south of the Navajo Nation in a small Arizona rural town. Went to a small public high school there. And I think if you would have asked younger me if I would have ever dreamed of working at NASA, I would have said no. I didn't see anybody really from my community or my family or from my school or to go down this path and end up at a place like NASA. So I never even considered it as a part of my plans or my dreams, you know, like I didn't dream that high. And it took a bit of confidence boosting, I think, for me to start to realize what my capabilities were And that confidence boosting came from mentors. It came from summer programs that I went to that were geared towards helping Native Americans deal with higher education or help them understand like what kind of careers they might want. I did already at a young age start to navigate, like sort of steer towards STEM. My parents are both kind of in the STEM field. My mother was a math teacher, and my dad became a civil engineer, and he worked on the roadways up in northern Arizona. And so I was following their footsteps. I soon learned somewhere along the way that I could be creative, I could be a design thinker, I could be a conceptual thinker, and work to communicate these ideas that I have in my head on paper or on a presentation or something. And so that's sort of what got me on the path towards mechanical engineering. When I was in a freshman year, sophomore year of college, when I started to go for internships, I actually got an internship at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center first. And then the following summer, I got an internship at NASA Glenn Research Center. And that was sort of the first time I was like, wow, I'm at NASA. I'm actually doing the work here. I can do the work. I can handle it. And actually, I think I'm pretty good at it. And so I think that's what got it in my head that I want to even try to apply for a position when I was going to graduate. And so my senior year, I went to a career fair at this giant conference that's called the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. And that's where I met the recruiter for NASA JPL and sent in my resume and got my interview.
Aaron, you say something, you said something that I feel like I hear far too often, and it's growing up, you didn't see someone like you doing the thing that you're doing now. That's got to be why a program like Native America from PBS and particularly your role in this is so important, right? I mean, is that the goal that you want to get, you know, kids that were like you that didn't see that to be exposed to people like you doing really, really cool things and really important things like this?
Yeah, I think so. I really hope that somebody can see themselves, their path, their future in my story on that program. And like I said, a lot of the stuff that I had to do, I had to sort of figure out for the first time. Like I ended up going from my small hometown to Stanford, and that was like a big leap, and a lot of people hadn't done that before me. So I had to like learn how to survive in this like really big, prestigious university and navigate that and make sure I didn't fail and have to come home. I had to finish and I had to keep my scholarships. And then from there, leaped up again and got to NASA. And once you get your foot in the door, it's one thing, but also you have to survive there again. So another journey for me to sort of like learn what I need to do my job right and make sure I'm doing well. And then it wasn't enough for me to get my foot in the door and just work on small side projects, little projects over in the corner. Like I wanted to be part of the big thing that NASA was working on. And those are those Mars rovers, those big flagship missions. And I wanted a meaty role in those. And so it took me a while, a journey to work my way to that. I think for younger people like me, young students who are dreaming big, like if the dream seems too big, they might not be encouraged to go down that path, you know? And I'm hoping that if they see something like someone like me, someone that looks like them on the screen, that they can be encouraged to do that.
And Aaron, that's just one step, right? I mean, in communities like Native American communities, they have historically been underserved when it comes to providing educational resources, outreach resources. You've outlined some of the challenges that you encountered growing up. I mean, what else needs to happen in Native American communities like yours and throughout the country to really empower these younger people to follow in those footsteps?
I think it requires support at every level, like elementary school, support those dreams, high school, help them find those scholarships and colleges. I only ended up going to Stanford because somebody told me, hey, you're actually smart and you should dream bigger. You know, like don't limit your dreams to just what you know or what you've been shown your entire life. And so we need people like that who are willing to go the extra mile to encourage students to really like exceed their expectations. It was really difficult for me to get through college and not like you have to keep financial aid, you have to stay on top of your classes, but you're also pulled in so many directions. If you enter as a Native American, you're one of a very small community, right? I was less than a percent of what Stanford student population was. And so we kind of came together and we helped each other out. But there's also a bunch of things involved in that where you have to participate, be a leader, and be a voice for your people at such a young age. That's just another stressful thing that can happen when you're one of a few people in an area. And then now that I'm at NASA, it's the same thing where wherever I go, I'm usually the only Native American in the room. We're still less than 1% of the people of the population there. And we're still working to create a community, a pipeline for people to come in. And we do it, like me as an employee, I'm doing a lot of work to uphold an employee resource group, do outreach to students back home and other Native communities. I'm also trying to recruit college students and try to show them the path to get into a place like NASA. And then all of that on top of my day job of being a mechanical engineer and trying to build these drill bits and gather samples on Mars. So and so I think it just needs support. And I'm very thankful that the place where I work, they have shown a great amount of support, giving us funding and a space and mentorship at the highest level. That's all been great. So I think part of it, yeah, is helping people get there. And then also people like me and institutions making room and making space for these students who are coming up. Because even though we have a low representation right now, I think more and more students are starting to realize I can do that. I'm seeing people that are doing that, and there's more and more of us coming. So we got to make way for them.
The program itself, Aaron, is not just for students, right? I mean, this PBS program is presenting a modern portrait of contemporary Native Americans, and you know, with the audience being all sorts of people. What do you want us as the audience to take away from your episode, New Worlds? What should we learn from you sharing your experience on this platform?
I'm really excited for people to be able to see it. The shots they gathered are just beautiful. And I got to go back home to the Navajo Nation and film in a couple locations back home. And I've just never seen it put on the screen in that way. It's just so beautiful. There's two things that kind of come about. Like I feel like I'm always sort of moving back and forth between trying to prove that Native Americans aren't part of the past. We are here. We're modern people. We're part of everyday society. We're contributing, but also we are so unique. You know, like we are still rooted in our past, and we are still like holding on to very old traditions. So I guess it's just funny to try to like make those two arguments. But like I said, I think there's a lot of us who are making a bunch of effort to bring these two worlds that people think are separate together, to make sure that I can fully be myself and be like remember the things that I learned growing up from my grandparents and from many ancestors before, but also be in this NASA laboratory and not have to change who I am. And I think sometimes there are a bit of differences in culture. Like I'm in the workplace, I'm always encouraged to be a little bit more forward, a little bit louder, and that's just something that I've never been used to growing up. Like all of my elders and the leaders I've seen before me have just led in a different way. And I've made a big push more recently. I'm encouraging everybody, like, you can be a leader in many different ways.
And Aaron, it is not lost on me that the American Southwest looks incredibly like the surface of Mars, does it not?
Right, exactly. Yeah, if you ever drive up in northern Arizona, northern, like New Mexico, Utah especially, there's that whole high desert landscape with all those red rocks, the mesas, all of that stuff looks so similar to all the pictures that are coming down from Mars. And that's not a coincidence. Like Mars and Earth are the same kind of planet. They're both terrestrial, rocky planets that have a similar makeup on the inside. So the core, mantle, and crust. They also have volcanic activity. They have Mars quakes, just like we have earthquakes. They have once had water all over its surface. And so we believe that Mars and Earth sort of grew up together. They started to develop on a similar timeline. And Mars is unique because it kind of, its outer surface is still very old. It hasn't, like if you can imagine on Earth, we have these tectonic activities that sort of bring new Earth up from the internal core in terms of the landform. And so our surface is young, like relatively young compared to like Mars, where they don't have that kind of cycling going on. And so we can go to a place like Mars and look at a rock that's been on its surface, and it probably has been there from the beginning of its development, which is like a really unique way to be able to look really far into the past of a rocky planet. And so we're hoping to figure out how a planet like our own planet, like a terrestrial rocky planet, can develop over billions of years. What are the things that make it develop differently? And if it had water and maybe it was warmer at one point, maybe it once had tiny little microbial life that started to form at the bottom of these waterways and lakes and stuff on a similar timeline to when they started to develop on Earth. And so that would be a really exciting discovery to see that life started to possibly develop on another planet other than Earth.
It sounds very familiar to your take on your journey, looking to the past to inspire and understand the future. I think it's almost poetic.
Yeah, and actually, I can even expand on that, is that as Native people, as Navajos, we put a big emphasis on our origin stories. Like, there's a bunch of traditional stories that talk about how we sort of came to be in this land in our between the four sacred mountains of the Navajo Nation, and how not only just like people came to emerge, but also the landforms around us, all the animals, how they came to look the way they did, how the constellations in the sky got formed. And so understanding exactly where you came from is an important part of our Navajo values. And so that's almost like exactly what I'm doing with NASA, is understanding, how does life originate? Where did we come from? How did we come to be in this like solar system?
That was Aaron Yazzi, a NASA engineer at the Jet Propulsion Lab. He's profiled in season 2 of Native America on PBS that debuts October 24th. Still to come, the new lunar boom. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. It's been more than a half century since humans touched the lunar surface, and now with NASA's upcoming Artemis missions, the agency is going to try once more. With NASA entering this new era of discovery, exploring the moon could lead to a new boom in the commercial space sector. Here to talk more about this new chapter in lunar exploration is Rob Meyerson, former president of Blue Origin, and now the founder and CEO of De La Lune Space. Rob, welcome to the show. Well, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Glad to have you here, Rob. You know, on this show, we've talked quite a bit about the scientific interest in going back to the moon, but there is a very strong commercial interest to return as well. Broadly speaking, why is the commercial industry so excited about getting back to the moon?
Well, I think it starts with one word. It's Artemis, which is NASA's program, NASA-led program to go to the moon and on to Mars. It was started the last decade, and it is, you know, being led by NASA, but has a range of international partners. And, you know, launch costs of access to space have come down so significantly over the last 5 to 10 years that, you know, with Artemis and the investment that's being made in Artemis in rockets and landers, we have the opportunity to do some commercial things as well. And NASA's making that commitment to go to stay. And What stay means to me is that we're going to have long-term presence on the moon for science and commercial activities.
Yeah, that's what sets this aside so differently from the Apollo missions, right, is the fact that this will be a sustained presence for both scientific and commercial opportunities, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if we want to go to the moon with the objective of eventually going on to Mars, there's so much we can learn on the moon, but we do. You know, I fully expect we'll have people living on the moon conducting those scientific and commercial activities and building a base that will grow over time.
What kind of commercial activities are we talking about? Because, you know, my head first goes to, you know, building a manufacturing plant on the moon, which I don't think would be financially smart. But what are these commercial activities that we're actually talking about?
Well, they can be from anything from scientific research and manufacturing that takes advantage of the vacuum, the thermal gradients on the moon, the lower gravity, to making propellants that serve vehicles that go back and forth for government and other purposes. We've learned since the Apollo program that there is water ice on the moon in the poles, and a lot of our goals for Artemis are to go to the South Pole and extract that water ice and turn it into water that we can drink, but also water that we can turn into rocket propellant, liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen that can power vehicles that are being built now by companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin.
With these activities and these opportunities, is the customer the federal government? Or who is actually, you know, paying for these services and this development?
Yeah, the federal government is paying for a lot of it, the U.S. and other countries, but there's also private investment going into lunar exploration. According to Euroconsult, a consulting firm, more than $37 billion will be invested in lunar exploration between now and 2031. And NASA is leading the way, building large rockets and landers and new lunar rovers and even a new space station called the Gateway. So all the big household names are participating, but there's also, as I mentioned, private investment going into companies like Astrolab and Intuitive Machines and Astrobotic and Firefly. These are not names that you may have heard of, but they're making a big contribution to the future lunar economy. And the result of this investment, of course, will serve government, but it will result in a set of capabilities that can be used to establish new businesses that can be built on top of this infrastructure. So we're looking to entrepreneurs to build something new, just like cloud computing did for the internet almost 20 years ago. So for example, Brendan, there's more than a dozen small lunar lander missions that are going to be conducted between now and the end of 2026. These are the launch customer, so to speak, is NASA through a program called CLPS, Commercial Lunar Payload Services. But there's lots of other customers paying for what we call rideshare payloads, small tag-along payloads that'll go along on those landers that are commercial companies and, scientific organizations as well.
You know, Rob, this next question might be kind of a chicken or the egg question here, but, you know, what is driving this development? You know, is the federal investment in this with the Artemis program driving the commercial development behind it? Or is Artemis successful because the commercial development was in place that could help NASA meet this ambitious goal?
I think it's a little bit of both, but maybe leaning more towards the government driving that investment. And we've seen that historically, government investment in, you know, ARPANET, which is a predecessor to the internet, government investment in space and defense that have trickle down or spin-off technologies that certainly serve the private sector and the public as a whole. But there are things, you know, there are things on the moon, resources on the moon that will have long-term benefit to humanity. I mean, when we think about what the commercial opportunities are going to be on the moon, there are natural resources on the moon that can be used to benefit Earth. And then there also are natural resources on the moon that can serve a future in-space economy. So I mentioned water ice, and that can be used to make rocket fuel. So unlike Apollo, our lunar landers that are being developed by SpaceX and Blue Origin are going to be reusable. So if you imagine that you've got the ability to make fuel from water on the moon, then you can imagine these landers landing on the moon and then being refueled at a lunar gas station, so to speak, and then taking off and heading off to the next destination. So we're not leaving behind all this hardware. We're reusing it, much like we're reusing rockets now here on Earth. And so you can see a future where the government is leading the way towards producing this in-space economy led by propellant. Another example might be helium-3, which is a stable isotope of helium. It's extremely rare on Earth because it's only produced from tritium, which is an element created in our nuclear weapon stockpile. But helium-3 is plentiful on the moon because it's produced within the natural fusion process in the sun. So we have this sort of a helium-3 supply crisis of sorts here on Earth. And the U.S. government is now rationing it because there's just not enough to meet demand from industries like quantum computing and national security. So if you had more helium-3, it could be, you know, used to support these growing demands, as I mentioned, but also for other industries like medical imaging and fusion energy. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg, but we are definitely seeing government investment leading the way towards enabling these potential future outcomes.
And Rob, you know, we are not the only ones interested in the moon. Obviously, Artemis is led by NASA, but has lots of international collaborators with it. But China also has lunar ambitions as well. Are there concerns with China eyeing the moon as well? And will they have kind of the same plans for utilizing these resources on the moon?
Yeah, I think, China's made a lot of progress. They've done an amazing job. And they flew to the far side of the moon in 2018. They flew to the moon in 2020 and recovered samples and brought them back to Earth. They'd been publishing journal articles in scientific journals about what they've learned from the lunar surface, using ground penetrating radar to look at obstacles below the surface and learn more about how the moon was formed, looking at helium-3, what I mentioned earlier, and how much helium-3 is in the lunar regolith, and what are the geological processes that allow it to be there. Since their last mission in 2020, they've built their own space station in low Earth orbit, and they've announced human missions to the moon later this decade, partnering with countries like Russia, Pakistan, Venezuela, and South Africa. And they're also planning an international lunar research station. Russia has its own space program. They failed to land their Luna 25 spacecraft just last month, and that creates an opportunity for other countries to step forward. And China will certainly be one of them. My opinion is that puts pressure on the U.S. and Western nations to continue to invest in space. And I think that's important that we continue to maintain our capabilities, our industrial base, and continue to move forward. There are other countries going to the moon, too, besides China. India just landed on the moon a few weeks ago. And countries like Japan, Israel, Australia, and the UK also have lunar exploration ambitions and spaces for all of us. So expanding our capabilities as an industry and as a world is a big net positive.
Finally, Rob, I want to talk about something a little bit closer to home, which is the growing issue of space debris. In an interview with Washington Post last year, you called space traffic management one of the grand challenges of our generation. Are you optimistic that we are up to meeting that challenge? And are we moving in the right direction when it comes to dealing with the growing issue of space debris?
Boy, thanks for the reminder there, Brendan. I think we are up to that challenge. We have to be there. Technologically, we can do it. We have to hold companies accountable for being good stewards of space. Companies and countries. I should add, we, you know, just in the last few years have staffed the office that manages space debris and object in orbit around Earth. And so, yes, absolutely, we're up to that challenge. Technologically, I think, you know, there are companies that are interested in space debris and working at recovering space debris, building the subsystems like propulsion and tugs, space tugs that will either reboost or deorbit spent satellites after their end of life. So we know how to do it. The key is the coordination amongst companies within the U.S. and amongst countries to go and make it happen.
And are we at the moment where we need to be issuing a red alert to the general public? You know, when you talk about space debris, not many people outside of the industry are too concerned with it. Do they need to be?
I think the industry is concerned at an appropriate level. I don't think we need to put a red alert out to the general public. I think the industry is appropriately concerned about it and is working the problem. So
great. And finally, Rob, you know, what are you most excited about in the world of commercial space over the next, say, 6 months to a year?
Oh, that's easy, Brendan. We've created competition in our U.S. space launch and satellite industry over the past decade with a range of new players led by companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin. And now there's a new slate of lunar landers and lunar rovers that are coming next. The next missions to the moon will be U.S. companies. Intuitive Machines and Astrobotic have landers that are being prepared for launch later this fall. And these are some, you know, names that most folks haven't heard of that we're going to see participating in this. You know, some of these will succeed, some won't. But what we're doing is we're really strengthening the industrial base here in the U.S. around, you know, lunar exploration and planetary exploration. And I think that is that's a good thing. It really, really excites me to see all the new players and all the new opportunities for engineers and scientists coming into the industry.
Great. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Brendan, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. And until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.